Hello and welcome to the May 2012 podcast for the IFRS Interpretations Committee meeting. Mine is Michael Stewart, Director of Implementation Activities at the ISB, and I'm joined by Liz Figge, Patrick LaFlau, and Martin Friedhoff of the ISB staff. Before we start the podcast, I'd just like to remind you all that the views that you hear and the comments that you hear in this podcast are those of the presenters and are not necessarily those of the IFRS Interpretations Committee or the ISB. Formal conclusions and decisions of both the ISB and the IFRIC Interpretations Committee are published in standards issued by the board or by the committee and only after full due process. We'll start off with an issue related to Greek government bonds, and the financial difficulties in Greece are in the news every day at present. As a result of these difficulties, the Greek government announced on the 21st of February the key terms of a transaction known as the private sector involvement. This transaction, which was conducted in the context of the Greek economic reform programme that has been agreed with the European Union and the International Monetary Fund, involves an invitation to private sector holders of Greek government bonds to exchange their holdings for new bonds to be issued by the Greek state. Now, a question was submitted to the Interpretations Committee about how a holder of these bonds should account for the old bonds that it holds. Now, Martin, you were involved in presenting this issue to the Interpretations Committee. The transaction itself has a number of components to it. What are they, and which part did the Interpretations Committee focus on in its discussions?
Well, the committee looked at the transaction structure as actually slicing the bonds into different parts for which there is different remuneration or consideration that you receive in exchange. One part was obviously forgiven, so there's nothing that you get for that. Then there was another part for which you receive new Greek government bonds, but those have fairly different maturities than the original ones. There are 20 new installments, or rather bond tranches, that come with it. They have different stepped coupon payments, so fairly different profile from what you actually exchange it for. Then you get some new bonds from the European Stability Facility, and so that's a different debtor that you then have. And then there was also a kind of security that is linked to the GDP growth of Greece in the future. And then there were some other aspects like bonds that compensate for accrued interest that there was. And that was a rather complex transaction overall, but there were those pieces. And then the committee also looked at some other changes that were made as part of that transaction. And those were, for instance, that the law was changed. So the new bonds used the laws of England and Wales. Contractual collective action clauses were also included, and there was also a co-financing agreement that had an implication for the future Greek government bondholders compared to how they rank to other creditors of Greece.
And the committee discussed this. They reached a tentative view on the accounting and how these particular Greek government bonds should be accounted for in this transaction. What was their tentative view?
Well, the easy bit was that the tentative view was it should all be derecognized. And then the question is, what arguments got you there? Ultimately, the IFRIC discussed several different arguments, but they all had the same outcome, which is derecognition of the entire bond that was exchanged. And the staff papers were written in a way that we looked at analyzing that view that was most biased towards getting derecognition for only parts and letting one part survive as a modification. And in our analysis, we even demonstrated why that would not work. And then there are different ways to get there. But the big picture is that once you have concluded on that part it doesn't work, then obviously it does clearly not work if you look at the transaction as one and not the different parts of the principal amount separately. So that's where the committee got pretty quickly to. And there were then some discussions whether you could view it as a transfer under the asset derecognition guidance, and most committee members thought you could not view it as a transfer because in this case the asset surrendered is given back to the issuer, and viewed it more as an extinguishment because the new bonds received were so different. And so there was this common element of a substantial change between the terms and conditions of what you surrendered and what you got in return. And no matter how you looked at it, whether it was an extinguishment view or it was a view of if we treat it as a modification, the same substantive changes that I talked about under your first question led the committee to conclude that there's full derecognition.
Okay. And so the new bonds that are recognized as brand new bonds at fair value at the date of...
Yes, and the day that you exchange the bonds, so you have then received the new bonds and they are treated like any other newly acquired instrument at fair value, yep, initial measurement, and you do the normal classification measurement exercise.
Okay. And what other questions did the committee also look at that were included in the submission?
Well, there were several questions in the submission. Some didn't need to be answered because the committee had reached this view that there's full derecognition. So some questions that related to assuming these bonds would not at least completely derecognize and part would survive, and what would the accounting be? The committee said, well, given that is now a null set, we don't need to answer those questions. But there was one more question that the committee did discuss, and that was, what is the classification for this one bit that is the security that was given to the bondholders that is linked to the future performance of the Greek GDP? And there was the question, can you narrow it down? Because there is uncertainty about the interpretation of the definition of a derivative, specifically the part that says there is a non-financial variable specific to a party to the contract, and so given that it's linked to Greek GDP and the Greek government is the issuer, that was something where the committee said there have been several attempts in the past by the committee and the board to clarify that, that all ran into difficulty and ultimately was a dead end. So it's not foreseeable that the committee this time around would be more successful. Mm-hmm. But they said, if you do not treat it as a derivative, and without prejudice accepting that as a given and not commenting whether it's appropriate or not, they said it still would not be possible to classify it then into an amortized cost category, so loans and receivables or held to maturity, but it would have to be classified as available for sale then. And committee members also noted that even for available for sale, you have to obviously do an effective interest calculation in the background to determine what gains and losses or income and expenses go to profit or loss. And given that this GDP security is in essence a structured option, you would be hard pressed to come up with any sensible effective interest method application in the background.
Yes. So as you say, a complex transaction with some complex instruments involved in it, and quite an involved discussion and conclusion then that the committee reached. Now, these views of the committee, including its decision not to propose any amendments to the standards, are obviously tentative at present, and they're published in a tentative agenda decision in the IFRIC update newsletter. Now, of course, as with all tentative agenda decisions, they're open for public comment for 60 days. And so please do write to us if you have comments on the committee's decision, including comments on the wording of the decision. And the committee will consider the comments it receives at its meeting in September. Thank you, Martin. And then the next item that we'll move on to, we'll talk to Patrick. The second issue to talk about today relates to a decision that the committee took to publish for public comment a draft interpretation on levies charged by public authorities. Now, Patrick, you were involved in preparing for and presenting this issue to the committee. Could you tell us a little more about the background and the scope of this draft interpretation?
Yes, Michael. Well, the draft interpretation deals with the accounting for levies in the financial statements of the entity paying the levy. Put simply, the question relates to when a liability to pay a levy should be recognized. And I should first point out that the draft interpretation addresses the accounting for levies that are recognized in accordance with IS 37. The draft interpretation does not address the accounting for income taxes that are in the scope of IS 12. One of the concerns expressed in the requests was about the accounting treatment to be applied when the calculation basis of the levy is based on data related to a period that precedes the period in which the levy is triggered. So let me give you an example. For example, the payment of the levy is triggered in 2011 and the calculation of the levy is based on revenues generated in 2010. So what is the accounting treatment for this levy?
So what are the issues that the committee considered and addressed within this interpretation?
Well, the committee's addressed several issues, cross-cutting issues, when reaching its consensus in the draft interpretation. In particular, we can note some of the issues addressed by the committee. The committee looked at the definition of an obligating event in IS 37 to determine what the obligating event is for a liability to pay a levy. In doing this analysis, the committee also considered whether the so-called economic compulsion to continue operating in a future period creates a constructive obligation to pay a levy. The committee also considered whether the recognition of a liability to pay a levy always arises at a point in time or whether in some circumstances it arises progressively over time. And lastly, the committee also considered the accounting treatment in the interim financial statements.
So could you summarize for us the consensus that the committee has reached on this topic?
Well, I think that the main conclusion of the committee is that the obligating event that gives rise to a liability to pay a levy is the activity that triggers the payment of the levy as identified by the legislation. So this means, for example, that if the activity that triggers the payment of the levy is the generation of revenue in 2011, and the calculation of the levy is based upon the revenues generated in 2010, then the obligating event for that levy is the generation of revenues in 2011, and the liability will be recognized in 2011 and not in 2010. Another example, if the activity that triggers the payment of the levy is to operate as a bank at a specific date specified by the legislation, then the obligating event is to operate as a bank at the date specified by the legislation. We should note that in reaching this conclusion, the committee clarified that an entity does not have a constructive obligation to pay a levy that will arise from operating in a future period as a result of being, for instance, economically compelled to continue operating in that future period. Similarly, the committee also clarified that the preparation of financial statements under the going concern principle does not imply that an entity has a present obligation to continue operating in the future. And therefore, it does not lead to the recognition of a liability at a reporting date for levies that will arise from operating in the future period.
Now, does this mean that all liabilities to pay levies are recognized at a single point in time?
No. The liability to pay a levy will be recognized progressively if the obligating event occurs over a period of time. That is to say, again, if the activity that triggers the payment of the levy occurs over a period of time. So, for example, if the payment of the liability is triggered progressively as the entity generates revenue during, say, 2011, then the liability to pay a levy is recognized progressively during 2011.
Now, I know one of the concerns that was raised as part of the submission was what happens in the interim financial statements. Now, what did the committee conclude in this area?
Well, the committee confirmed the basic principle that is in IS 34, that is to say, the same recognition principles should be applied in the interim financial statements as are applied in the annual financial statements. So, as a result, the levy expense should not be anticipated if there is no present obligation to pay the levy at the end of the interim reporting period, or it should not be deferred if a present obligation to pay the levy exists at the end of the interim period.
Now, we start off by saying that the committee had voted to issue a draft interpretation. What are the next steps? What's the timing associated with this draft interpretation?
Well, we can expect that the draft interpretation will be published in June, end of June, and with a 90-day comment period.
Okay. And then comments back on that will be discussed at some future
comments date. Will be discussed again by the committee for the issue of a final interpretation.
Okay. So please do look out for the publication of this draft interpretation when it is finalised, and do respond to us within that comment period so that the Interpretations Committee can take into account your views on its proposals when it comes back to look at these items again. Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you.
And then our final issue relates to put options written over non-controlling interests. And Liz, you were involved in developing the papers and presenting these on this issue. What's this issue about, and why do we need to develop guidance in this area?
Well, as you mentioned, the issue arises when a parent writes a put option on the shares of its subsidiary that are held by non-controlling interest shareholders. And that contract is often referred to as an NCI put. So in the parent's consolidated financial statements, the NCI put is a contract to purchase its own equity, the NCI. So if the parent is obliged to purchase those shares for cash or for another financial asset, then IS 32 requires it to recognize a financial liability for the present value of the option exercise price. So constituents raised a concern to the Interpretations Committee about diversity in the subsequent measurement of that grossed up financial liability. And that diversity arises because of a potential conflict between the requirements in IS 39 and IFRS 9 for measuring financial liabilities and the requirements in IS 27 and IFRS 10 for accounting for transactions with owners in their capacity as owners. And specifically, some believe that changes in the liabilities measurement must be recognized in P&L, but others believe that those changes must be recognized directly in equity.
So we're seeing some diversity in practice at present between those two views, is that right?
Correct.
Right. So what are we proposing to deal with this and address this diversity?
The committee is proposing to address that diversity by requiring all changes in the measurement of the NCI put to be recognized in P&L in accordance with IS 39 and IFRS 9. So the committee noted that the remeasurement of that financial liability doesn't change the parents or the non-controlling interest shareholders' respective interests in the subsidiary, so it would be inappropriate to recognize those changes directly in equity.
Okay, so the committee's proposing this guidance be included in a draft interpretation. What are the next steps now with that?
Well, we aim to publish that draft interpretation for public comment by the first week in June. And since the committee decided on a 120-day comment period, comments would be due round about the beginning of October. Given that time frame, I would expect the committee to discuss the comments at its November 2012 meeting, with re-deliberations perhaps continuing at its January 2013 meeting. So after considering all the comments received, if the committee decides to finalize this interpretation, it likely would have an effective date no earlier than January 1st, 2014.
Right. Okay. Well, that's good to get that into perspective in terms of the time there, and obviously something to look out for in about a month's time as we see the draft interpretation being published and available for comment. Thank you. Well, that brings us to the end of this podcast, and just a reminder that the views that you've heard today are those of the presenters and not necessarily those of the IFRS Interpretations Committee or the International Accounting Standards Board. The official record of the proceedings of the IFRS Interpretations Committee meeting for May is included in IFRIC Update available on the IASB website. And in there you'll also find information about the other issues that were discussed at that meeting, including the matters that were published as tentative agenda decisions. There are three issues that are subject to consultation there in terms of tentative agenda decisions, one of which you heard about today, which was to do with the accounting for restructuring of government Greek government bonds. And there are also two others, one related to the purchase of right-to-use land and the other to do with accounting for contribution-based promises, looking at the impact of the 2011 amendments to IAS 19. And comments on those are requested by 23rd of July 2012. And those tentative agenda decisions will be reconsidered by the committee at its September 2012 meeting. Thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye.